independent trade comics. Today we are reviewing Aline and the Others by Guy Delisle, or Guy Delisle, and Welcome to Hawksford by Ben Templesmith. And you can check us out at stumptowntradereview.blogspot.com or on MySpace or on Twitter. So what do you want to start out with?
Let's start off with Aline and the Others.
All right. So how did you feel about this overall?
I loved this book. I really think that this is everything that is right with comic books. It's not the kind of thing you will ever see published by Marvel or DC or any of the other big companies, but it really shows the diverse possibilities that comic books and the visual storytelling medium can have. In this really short book, you get 26 distinctly different stories covering a whole range of situations and emotions. Most of them are funny, but it's something that is a complete reading experience, and I was just impressed beyond belief with it. How about you?
I guess I felt the other way, and I felt like it was a little too pretentious, I guess, with the whole theme of humans consuming other humans, and especially related to love or sexual relations.
I can see that. There was a lot of blending of love or sex with some sort of horrific act. And, you know, for people that haven't seen it, we're not talking about bodies being ripped apart and, you know, brains splattered everywhere. We're talking more about almost like a Bill Plimpton cartoon where someone stretches a mouth and crawls inside of somebody, yeah, or consumes some, makes themselves a part of somebody else or somebody else a part of them, as opposed to a real horror situation, yeah, like a zombie or something. You know, and I can see that you can see how it was pretty pretentious in that it's all to the extreme. I mean, yeah, there's nothing in here that's played for subtlety. The romance in this is pretty overt.
Yeah. Like the one that we were reviewing beforehand, where it's the girl pulls her heart out. It's still attached to her on a string. She shows it to one guy, he runs off screaming. She shows it to another guy, he jumps up and down on it. And then eventually she shows it to Death, who pulls one out. The Grim Reaper, right, I should say. And then they walk off into the sunset, essentially. And so that, to me, is, like you say, overt and obvious, and there's no subtlety there.
That was Xavier, I believe. It's all, like you mentioned, the guy who wrote this and drew it is French-Canadian. What I was impressed with, though, is that it's completely international. It's almost completely wordless. There's some ha-has and, you know, a couple of sound effects like bang that, you know, translate almost universally.
Yeah.
And I think that that's part of even the charm of the girl who pulls her heart out and shows it to everybody, is that we're dealing with universal experiences here. And there are some universal desires that are exhibited in this. This desire to, you know, be able to do some of these things. I'm looking at Judith right now. To be the homely person and be able to just pull out a beautiful woman from inside of you to go off and deal with other people, you know, to show various sides of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So I can see, you know, the universal appeal to this book. And again, there are also some real nightmares in this. There's Elodie, who is always, the moment she runs away and starts to get happy, her mother pulls her back, starting at a very early age, and it shows repeatedly over and over her mother pulling her back and pulling her back until eventually, even in death, her mother reaches up through the grave and sucks her down into the grave with her. And I saw it as being more metaphorical than a real physical thing, but how our parents hold on to us far beyond a time when it's appropriate and still have an impact over us today.
Sure, and I think it speaks also to overprotective parenting.
Right.
And the damages of that. There are several in there that I thought were well done, but overall, I just, as a book in total, I found it to be somewhat pretentious.
The other thing that I was impressed with, since we're just going to disagree on this one left and right, was it's laid out almost exactly like Fell, in that every single one of these stories is laid out in a 15-panel grid. Fell, I think, was laid out in a 9-panel grid. Yeah. But this is laid out in a 15-panel grid, every single one of these stories. And while occasionally you will have a few panels pushed together here and there, it still follows the 15-panel grid. And I was really impressed with the way that he was able to show such a variety of shots, such a variety of action, all in this very strict grid system that modern artists have tried so hard to break away from, feeling that it was too restrictive. And it's nice to see someone go back to it and show how this system actually helps to tell a story. There's no getting lost on these pages. It's very clear what the artist slash writer is trying to show in sequence, whereas you don't get that ruined surprise that you get in a modern comic where, you know, one panel sort of bleeds into another panel, leads your eye to another page, and the big reveal or whatever it is gets spoiled. In this one, with the panel grid so strict, your eyes don't jump over to the next page or don't jump ahead. You read it panel by panel.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. And it's almost like a direct rebound from contemporary comics where it's really all about mashing up that panel design. And this is the exact opposite of that. I'd agree. And it is kind of refreshing to see a story laid out that way.
Right. So, you know, apparently Guy Delisle has more books out. I'm going to go and find some more.
I thought that the ones on the back that are mentioned on the back sounded, or was it in the beginning? They sound really more interesting to me. One is Pyongyang, A Journey to North Korea, and then Shenzhen, a travelogue from China. And I'll probably definitely check those out, as they sound more interesting to me than this. And I think that he's definitely has talent. It just didn't really show through all that well for me in this format. Right. But I'd definitely be willing to check out his other books.
Because, I mean, even if you don't like what this book encompassed, there's no denying that he is a very able storyteller. And
it's original, too. I appreciated it for its originality.
And, you know, for as simple as the art is, I mean, no one's going to mistake his art for a Mike Deodato or, you know,
Ben Temple Smith.
It was very easy to follow and effective. So, you know, I really think that at a $9.99 or $9.95 price point, this is a great introduction to something. I felt like I really got a high quality product for a very reasonable price.
Again, it's that drawn and quarterly quality, you know, that you just almost can't go wrong with one of their books.
And I have to say, you've totally corrupted me, because the first thing I did when I was flipping through the book was try to smell it. And, you know, I don't know if my, you know, nasal factory is not as primed as yours, but I just didn't notice the smell this time like we did on the Pascal Blanchette books.
No, it's not the same type of paper or whatever process it is that causes that.
But now, every time I open a Drawn and Quarterly book, I have to sniff it, so...
Yeah.
Yeah, you'll know which one of us is, you know, which ones we are, because we're the guys sniffing the comic books.
You have anything else?
I'm good.
Our next book is Welcome to Hawksford by Ben Temple Smith, written and drawn by him. A plot overview for this book is we follow Ray Delgado basically from in the very first few pages as a child growing up all the way through a military career, and then we follow him through the aftermath of that, and he's in an insane asylum or a criminal insane asylum, and we basically see the varied characters that he's riding on a bus with to go to a new criminal insane asylum, which is called Hawksford. And so that basically, I mean, the story ends at Hawksford, so that basically covers it, don't you think?
Right. And I think that once again, for our listeners, if you have not read Welcome to Hawksford, stop now, because there's some big reveals that we are going to have to talk about. So
definitely, yeah.
If you haven't read it, stop listening, or if you don't mind, please, by all means, continue listening. You know, I think that for a horror story plot, this was a pretty solid plot. I mean, most horror stories have some gaping hole in their plot that it just drags you out of the story for a minute. It's the, you know, don't run upstairs type thing.
Yeah, I agree.
Or, you know, oh, wow, 86 people have been murdered at Camp Crystal Lake, but you're going to open your summer camp there.
Yeah.
There's all these things that are in a standard horror story, and I was just waiting for it in this one, and this horror story works.
Yeah.
It's
kind of like that 30 Days of Night where it's believable in the real world. Like, there's just been sort of these creatures that have been dormant or have been in the shadows for a long time, and then they find their perfect opportunity to strike, and they take it.
Right, and this one had the bonus of it being a locked room, basically, mm-hmm. that they were trapped inside. There was no escape. They had to deal with the creature. There was no getting in the car and just driving away.
Speaking to that point, one thing that kind of disturbed me, there was something that kind of bothered me about the art, like, all the way through, and I couldn't pinpoint it until I reached the end, and I think it was because I read Fell right before I read this, so somewhat back-to-back, and there is a definite sense of confinement in this book, in the art, and it's very almost disturbing, you know? It's visceral, the feeling of it. You feel confined in this book, almost claustrophobic. Whereas in Fell, there was this wide open, and he really built this landscape almost like it was, you know, an inch thick in ash, but you always saw, like, the background.
Right.
And so it really serves this book well. You at no point feel like you are in the open world. It always feels like you are trapped in a corner, you know, with your back against a concrete wall.
And I think that for me, I had the exact same feeling reading it. And what I noticed as I went back through it is at the start of the book, the coloring is yellows, reds, mm-hmm. oranges, going through to blues and greens. And then the further back you get, it gets darker and darker and darker until in the final, you know, half to third of the book, all the edges are darker than the middle of the picture. All of the edges are black, creeping in to the picture. And Temple Smith does a wonderful job with his light sources in this art, so that it's almost as if the characters themselves are providing the light.
Yeah.
So that around the edges is just a little bit darker, drawing your focus inward instead of outward, and really making you feel like you are just trapped inside this dark prison.
And I'm really glad, actually, that I read Fell right before this, because it had such a completely different point of view and really atmosphere. And I think that that is the thing that Temple Smith does the best, is really setting up this atmosphere for a book. It's almost an all-encompassing experience that I really hope that they don't make movies, because I don't think that that's something really that you could capture unless it's an animated picture by Temple Smith.
Either that or something like Das Boot, where it's just, you know, so intensely focused and narrow.
Yeah.
That it, but you're right. It would be difficult to capture that feeling. And again, I think a lot of it has to do with just how it was drawn or painted. That was the other thing I felt, is that I've had a really hard time getting into Ben Temple Smith's art. And it really wasn't until Fell, which I picked up for Warren Ellis as opposed to Ben Temple Smith. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until Fell where I felt like I could enjoy his art. I tried with 30 Days of Night. I've tried with a couple of other things, and I just didn't like the art. It just wasn't to my liking. His sense of character design has dramatically improved in the time since 30 Days of Night. And so I really felt like this is right now at his highest level of art.
And Do you think this is better than Fell?
I think this is better than Fell. I really do.
I actually think Fell is a little bit better, but they're both like almost neck and neck. It's almost hard to compare. They're almost apples and oranges. Even though if you flip open a book or a page from either book, you're going to immediately see the similarities. I feel like they are such completely different books. It's almost like apples and oranges.
I think what pushes it over for me is again, the lighting. Mm-hmm. And how he chooses to light each and every panel. Ray Delgado's eyes, the main character's eyes in every single panel, are glowing. Mm-hmm. Now, granted, that is a visual representation of his glasses, but at the same time, this is a character who has a multiple personality disorder, and the personality that is dominant throughout this book is this god personality. And to have this just hulking figure with these glowing eyes through the whole book. And again, whenever he's in a panel, not only are his eyes glowing, but radiating out from him is light. It just adds right there to that feeling like, wow, maybe, just for an instant, maybe he really is. Now, we as readers know he isn't. But, you know, when you believe in something so much that it becomes real for you.
Yeah.
Ray believing so strongly that he is this god.
I was almost wondering if it was going to take that path, honestly, as a reader reading it. I almost felt like it was going to move towards a more fantasy plot. And I was pleasantly surprised that it didn't, but I think it almost could have gone either way. I really like how it did end, but man.
See, and I thought that the ending was perfect, because I thought that that way he got the god status, but in a very human way.
Definitely, yeah. This was almost a perfect book. I mean, it was especially for a horror book, you never get this kind of quality of plot and character design out of a horror book. And so it was really refreshing.
It was. And, you know, what I found to be so impressive was Temple Smith does such a good job of setting up our main characters to be the absolute dregs of society.
Yeah.
He goes out of his way to make these people that the taxpayers would be happy to have sent away someplace and never have to worry about again. I mean, we're talking necrophiliacs, we're talking child molesters, serial killers, absolutely vile, horrible people. And to make us, the reader, actually care about their fate is a real trick. And some of them, you're cheering that they're getting destroyed.
Yeah.
And some of them, like Ray Delgado, he does a really good job of humanizing him to the point where you can go, wow, there's something else to this guy other than the fact he's a serial killer.
And that really comes from the point of view of Jessica Ainley.
Mm-hmm.
I think that without her there counterbalancing everything, really it changes the dynamic and it completely distorts us into a purely horror book that I think falls apart. I think that really having her there as sort of your rock of sanity and, you know, just humanity,
mm-hmm.
Really counterbalances everybody else and really draws you in as a reader into this story. And the way that he sets her up so that he doesn't make her out like a nun, like just the most perfect person in the world, but all that he shows us in her is that she cares about her patients and she wants to make sure that they're getting taken care of. And just that simple little conversation that he has her and then her getting thrown in later makes you completely care about her and the people that she's caring about at the same time. It really adds a humanity to this book where I think a lot of other writers wouldn't have added that or done it as well.
Right. And had her be completely helpless too.
Yeah.
I think would have been the other piece where other writers would have gone to, just making her completely helpless.
Sure.
And what I found the closest he came to that was when she's escaped from, you know, being locked up. She finds Ray and hugs him but it's not a helpless thing. It's the, I found somebody who isn't trying to kill me.
Yeah.
And maybe he'll protect me.
Yeah.
But even then,
I mean, at that point, everybody's better than what they're running from.
Right, right. But again, it isn't, you know, now he's my savior and he will protect me. It's maybe now he'll protect me and we can protect each other.
Yeah.
Because two is better than one. She actually kind of takes control of this group of misfits along the way too, to help try to get them out of here. One of the few times that I had a problem with characterization was with some of the other inmates.
Mm-hmm.
And there were particular moments that just didn't quite ring true to me, such as
The necrophiliac doing the dead werewolf.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean,
I had a problem with that too. That seemed like it was thrown in there for shock value and didn't serve any other purpose.
Right. You would think that a person's sense of self-preservation, no matter how, you know, perverse their need is, their sense of self-preservation would override that.
Sure.
And there were other times, I mean, that was the most blatant one. There were other times, though, when they were talking to Gravy.
Yeah, I think that the biggest problem with him was just the eating of the flesh as if it was, like, good raw or something. I don't know. I found that to be a little bit strange, and that it was the same sort of a thing. They're in this terrible situation where werewolves are hunting them, and he's stopping to chow down on a little meal, you know? Like,
right.
Just not reasonable.
Right. It's, you know, I can understand possibly that Temple Smith was trying to show people operating at their most base animal desires and instincts, almost giving a human counterpoint to the werewolves who are chasing everybody. Again, being, you know, the personification of the most, you know, animalistic that a, you know, a humanoid can go. But to have these characters stop and actually move up on the, you know, instinct ladder as opposed to down. I mean, the most basic instincts, fight or flight. And you would think in this situation where you're being actively hunted by werewolves, you're going to stay on that fight or flight until, you know, either you're dead or you've escaped. You're not going to move up to food. You're not going to move up to sex. You're not going to move up to any of these other things.
Yeah, I completely agree.
The other character, though, that I really liked as an antagonist was Warden Baker.
Yeah.
You know, I thought that he did a really great job. The Templesmith did a very good job of creating a very imposing and believable figure who has two very different sides. I mean, as Warden Baker, he is calm, cool, and collected.
Mm-hmm.
But inside, he is a wild animal.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's a werewolf just waiting to hunt at the full moon. And I thought that was a really interesting dichotomy that Temple Smith created in that character.
Sure, yeah. And it really speaks to the duality of him as he has this face that he shows the human world. And it's this very no-nonsense, no-cheer kind of business-only face. And then behind closed doors, he immediately, as soon as the doctor, Jessica Ainley, leaves, you know, offers the other prison guard meat. And it's like that first crack that we see, you know, this world isn't exactly the same.
Right.
And so, yeah, I thought that was a great character as well.
You know, and for a hokey, you know, comic book, horror comic book, I thought that the dialogue wasn't bad either.
No, not at all.
You know, again, I kept waiting for these just lousy, over-the-top monologues to come in, or some sort of just incredibly long expository statement that would throw me off. And it never happened. It really flowed together so well, and all of the characters had a very unique voice. I didn't have a problem telling them apart, which, given my earlier concerns about Temple Smith's art, I've always had a hard time telling his characters apart.
Mm-hmm.
And relied heavily on the dialogue. Now, with the characters being so visually striking and individual, I didn't have a problem telling them apart visually, and the dialogue was so good. Each person spoke with their own voice.
And he really could have gone hokey with the inner monologue of Ray as he's falling into insanity and really these delusions of grandeur. It really could have gotten hokey with that, but I felt like it was very believable as he's turning into what he believes is a god or whatever it is. It wasn't hokiness like you see in other comic books where they're going crazy and talking to themselves.
Right. He had a really strong grasp on Ray. Because you're right, he as a true god, you wouldn't need to brag and boast.
Mm-hmm.
You would be confident in your power to simply say, I will find your god and kill him.
Mm-hmm.
And leave it at that. You don't need to go on about crushing his bones and picking your teeth with them and all these other things that other writers would go for.
It could have been said, yeah.
It was the simple statements that he makes along the way that, again, just adds to that feeling of power that he has.
And speaking to what you said, before, I've never had a problem with seeing a difference between Temple Smith's characters. I think that that's one of the things that he does best, is really making striking differences between character designs. Mm-hmm. Is that something that you found that you've had a problem with before?
I have, and maybe it's just that the art is so difficult to get used to. I mean, it is so unlike anything else. I mean, now that, you know, he has become kind of a big name, there are plenty of imitators out mm-hmm. there. It is so different than what's out there, and so different than traditional comic book art. And so that's where I was coming from. That was the end of the spectrum that I was coming from, your traditional superhero yeah. comic art, and then opening up this, you know, 30 Days of Night, or, you know, I think he did Wormwood Gentleman Corpse. Yeah. It was just difficult for me. And yeah. so, you know, I don't know if just my eyes have, you know, seen enough now that I'm getting used to it, or, you know, it's been 6 months since I've been reading superhero comics, so maybe that's it, and I'm just being exposed to more and more art and really taking a look and focus at so many different styles. I don't know, but like I said, I didn't have a problem following this at all.
Yeah, definitely not. Each character is distinct, and you can really discern who they are almost from their dialogue alone. He does a really good job with that.
You know, one of the things also that I read about on his website is he was talking about how excited he was that this had finally been collected in a trade paperback, because when he wrote it, he basically wrote it with long form in mind.
Oh, that's interesting, because that was something that I really picked up on. At the end of each chapter, there is no cliffhanger whatsoever, and it just starts right in where pretty much where it left off. And that's something that you don't see very often unless it's just specifically a graphic novel.
Right.
And that's something that I really noticed, and it was really nice to read that way.
Right. So I think that this actually is one of those books that reads better in long form than in individual issues. Not just because of the having to wait each month, but because, you know, it was designed this way, and it really feels that way. It really feels like you're getting one full, complete story here, and there isn't, like you said, there isn't the recap page. There isn't the you know, cheesy cliffhanger. I really felt like the chapter breaks were at a place where, if I was reading a regular prose novel, that's where a chapter break possibly mm-hmm. could be.
Another thing, I don't think that you would notice the tonal shifts in color and in prose that happen in a monthly book, because they're really, like you said, that in the beginning it's yellows and oranges, and then it moves to blues, and then kind of into reds towards the end. And that's I think an important shift to observe and to take in, and I don't think that you would pick that up on a monthly.
No, and I'm excited that they included all the covers in the back. The covers yeah. just were gorgeous. I really appreciated all the back matter in this book. I mean, on the surface, it doesn't seem like much. You get all the covers, some alternate covers. You get some early character sketches. I mean, there isn't a whole lot back there text-wise. There isn't a whole lot of behind-the-scenes type stuff. But I really felt like it tied everything together so well. I was just impressed overall with the entire package. Like I said, the comic itself is gorgeous. The art is fantastic. The product is something that I am going to gladly show many people.
Yeah, this was a great piece. I think that IDW really does a good job, like with that Lock and Key book that I reviewed on the website. I mean, that is such a great presentation. It can sit next to any book that you've got, even next to an Absolute, right. and looks great. So I think IDW is really on the right path as far as their presentation goes with books.
You know, and at $20, I was, at first, you know, $20 for a collection of a comic book that would have run me, you know, pretty close to $20. It seemed a little much, but like I said, holding it in my hand, I mean, the paper quality in this is fantastic. The printing process in this is amazing. Really, there is nothing that I can find wrong about this product as a whole. And like you said, as far as story and art goes, it was almost the perfect book, which is amazing to say for such a strong genre piece as a horror comic.
I think if you take out those few scenes where it's the necrophiliac and the cannibal, you know, overriding their fight or flight, I think that it comes really close to being perfect, which is really surprising.
And I think that this does something that you've talked about before, where it leaves you with a feeling of you've had a complete experience, and at the same time leaves you wanting a little bit more. Mm-hmm. Like, I really could see the possibility of a follow-up to this not being forced. Yeah. I mean, the question remains, now what happens to Ray Delgado?
Yeah.
Now he has achieved this kinghood. Now he has achieved, you know, this godlike status among this pack of werewolves. And now what?
Yeah, so does he become a lycanthrope as well? Or, you know, what happens now? I could see that, but at the same time, like you said, I'm satisfied with this.
Right.
And it could be left alone, and I'd be almost just as happy because we don't get an episode 1, 2, and 3 action going on.
Right. I really don't. I mean, I really hope that this does not get diluted like the 30 Days of Night product has. 30 Days of Night was exciting. It was a fantastic concept. And then there was 30 Days of Night Return to Barrow. And then there was 30 Days of Night, you know, whatever. And 30 Days of Night, whatever else. And I mean, it's gotten to the point now where it's just gotten so diluted. I can see this potentially going the same way if there isn't some control shown. Because there's so much to tell. I mean, you've got a group of werewolves that came from Russia and somehow set up this corporation.
Yeah, multinational corporation.
Right. And so there's that story. There's the story of this, you know, Warden Baker's rise to power and overthrowing the old leader of the pack who he had locked away.
Which would essentially be a prequel to this.
Right. And then you have the sequel of what happens to Ray Delgado.
Mm-hmm.
Because you have to wonder, is the government going to continue to send psychopathic murderers to this Hoxford penitentiary now that there's been this big overthrow? So if it's almost more interesting that they don't. So now what do you do? How do you move Ray and this group of werewolves out of there into a new environment?
Mm-hmm.
And again,
there's got to be interesting dynamics because he's essentially a human that's overthrown their leader.
Right. And then what do you do with this doctor?
Yeah.
So there's so much potential for storytelling here. If it was in a controlled manner, I would love to read more.
Yeah,
I would hate to have this just spin out of control. And I'm kind of with you where I really don't want to see this as a movie. The 30 Days of Night movie was pretty good.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it.
But again, part of what made 30 Days of Night as a movie so accessible was that it was, you know, this one little spot in this wide open situation. You know, this vast nothingness, which is almost its own form of claustrophobia.
Mm-hmm.
Or agoraphobia, I guess, the exact opposite. Whereas this, you're dealing with claustrophobia, and how do you get that feeling to penetrate it without it just being some other horror movie?
Yeah.
But it's such a solid story. It's such a complete story. I wouldn't be surprised if in the next 6 months we hear about this being optioned for a movie.
Yeah.
So by all means, go out and get yourself a copy of Welcome to Hawksford by IDW.
Yeah, high recommendations. It was really good. So you've been listening to Stumptown Trade Review. We are at stumptowntradereview@blogspot.com. And we are on MySpace, Stumptown Trade, and on Twitter, Stumptown Trade. Come check us out and let's have further conversation on our website.